All right, we're back in BCL world, DevDiv world, .NET world. Nice to see you again, Emo.
Hey, Charles. Nice seeing you again.
How you doing, man?
Excellent. It's epic times to be a .NET developer right now.
It is. And it's also interesting. I remember the last time I interviewed you, you were about as young as the guy sitting next to you.
Yeah.
You were also an intern.
Yes, that was 2009, a long time ago.
Yeah, man. And now you've been doing really good things. So
thanks.
Rock and roll. So what's going on? What has our latest intern been up to?
Yeah, do you want to talk about it?
And sure. Who are you, man?
Hey, I am Ian Hayes. I'm a software developer intern for the summer here on the .NET BCL team.
Cool.
So my project is basically just to add collections to .NET. So I kind of started and looked around, read some stuff on like Stack Overflow and searches like that on MSDN to try to find out what people really want out of .NET that's not currently there. What collections that they're looking for that they haven't quite gotten. So that search led me a couple of different places to start.
Cool.
I started back in May, early May, and since then I have made a post on MSDN about my first collection, which is a multi-dictionary.
Explain.
Multi-dictionary. The multi-dictionary or the project?
Multi-dictionary.
So the multi-dictionary is essentially a dictionary that allows multiple keys to be added after each other. So
okay.
Basically, it allows non-unique keys.
Mm. And so what's a scenario where that's, like, clearly people have been wanting this, so what's a scenario where that makes sense?
So let's say you want a list of people's names, for example.
Mm.
So you have last name and first name, something like that.
Yeah.
So you want to add somebody to the multi-dictionary with last name Hayes, comma, Ian.
Cool.
And you want to add another person that's Hayes, comma, Anna. That's my sister's name.
Oh.
And then Hayes, comma, Susan, Hayes, comma, Robert, whatever.
Yeah.
And then you want to get a list of all of them. So you just want to look for people with the last name Hayes. So you get a list of them.
Mm-hmm.
In the old situation, what you'd have to do would be like a list of, or dictionary of string, comma, list of string or something like that.
Mm.
So then you'd have to go through the trouble of adding to check if there's already a list associated with that key, and then get that list and then add to that list. And this new multi-dictionary allows you to just do it all at once. Just
right.
Click add, key, comma, value.
Beautiful. So efficiency, productivity.
Yeah,
canonical .NET stuff.
Yeah.
That's
I'll jump in real quickly to introduce
and who
myself.
Are you?
Hi, I'm Matt Cohn. I was Ian's intern coach, so I'm also a developer on the .NET ecosystem team, which is real closely related with the BCL team. And so when Ian presented his ideas for what collections that he investigated and found useful, he found that this one, even during a regular team meeting, all of the developers around the room came up and said, I implemented that for my own project. And the multi-dictionary that Ian's implemented takes care of some corner cases that can be, you know, a little tricky when you implement it yourself, when you add the first of a key to a collection, or when you remove the last of a value associated with a specific key. And so it also takes care of the case where, like Ian was saying earlier, people used to implement this themselves using a dictionary of a string, comma, list of a T string, or list of string. And the problem with that is that when you have nested generics like that, it can cause a little bit of an explosion of generics in your type signatures. And so this is something that helps hide that, makes it a little cleaner from the
Great.
Consumer point of view. And so it's done a really cool job on it.
Excellent. So let's talk a little bit about the, you know, the implementation experience and what you've done. So, you know, clearly if other people have implemented this before,
mm-hmm.
when you have to implement something for a generic population of developers, you have to focus on, as you were saying, the corner cases, make sure it's super efficient, deal with security, blah, blah, blah.
Okay.
So take us through that experience of having an idea and then implementing it for general purpose use. And there's a lot of .NET developers out there,
yeah.
So it's got to be tightened up.
Yeah, the multi-dictionary is an interesting case, especially because there's a lot of different implementations out there, because I think everyone has had made their own implementation at some point. So everyone sort of has their own idea of what exactly the multi-dictionary should be. And there's a lot of different options, there's a lot of different opinions. It can be a lot of different things and do a lot of different things. So to start, it's just a lot of research, I think.
Okay.
A lot of asking questions from people around the team who have done it before and who want it again. A lot of people on MSDN and Stack Overflow again. So the first one, I really just wanted to get it out there and get a pretty generic implementation that's been seen a lot of different places, so nothing kind of too out of the ordinary. So I did that a few weeks ago now that it's been out.
Cool.
I'm getting a lot of good feedback on it.
Shipped. Yeah.
Shipped
to customers. Yeah.
Nice. People are using it in production already?
We don't know if they're using it in production.
Yeah.
It's
yes.
under, it's an alpha version,
yes.
So it's a pre-release version on NuGet, but the great thing about that is we were able to really quickly get his work out there, and as Ian mentioned, we've gotten lots of good feedback on it, so people have been using it and giving us their opinion, and so that's allowing us to take that into consideration for future versions, so it's
yeah.
great that we're able to
yeah.
get feedback on Ian's intern project while Ian is still an intern.
Cool.
So on the you know, adding it to the core part, like there, like I saw one comment on the blog, which by the way had like 60 comments, which is
nice.
Amazing. Like I think we have more comments on this one than we had on .NET Native, which is somewhat interesting. But like the amazing part is people really care. Right? That's obvious when you get a lot of comments. And then one of the comments was basically, I'd love to use this, and it will use it as soon as you add it to the BCL. And so there's still this view of the world that basically the .NET framework basically is still the thing that ships with Windows and with the OS. But we have changed this quite a bit now. Like, I mean, another good example is Immutable Collection. We shipped it on NuGet, and this is where we want to keep shipping it, because we want to move more and more stuff, basically, to a world that we can just ref it more frequently, can actually have previews, and more importantly, can actually take feedback. Because in the past, whenever we shipped a preview, it's like, you know, I don't know, Dev 12 preview or whatever, and then we have like 3 months left to actually ship the box version of the product, which also means we can barely touch anything at that point. Right? You can just identify really high impact bugs and try to fix those, but key design points like, oh, I don't like the namespace, or oh my god, you have like 5 types, I would really like to see this other type over here instead, and like doing drastic design changes is almost impossible. And the cool thing what Ian did, and traditionally in the BCL, what would have happened is he would have shipped the blog post shipped, right, with like a Word doc attached that says, here's the APIs that we think you can use, and then that's it. But now we're actually able to really give you working bits and say, this is what we think it should be. They can try it, they can play around with it, they, you know, see how the perv looks like, how the APIs actually feel like, and there's no smoke and mirrors, right? That's the real deal.
Great.
And so that's basically why I think our new like inbox version is basically a bunch of well-designed NuGet packages. And we are working on ways to actually make that experience a lot better in Visual Studio. So it's not just a bunch of, you know, a collection of libraries, but like a really, 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 really nice feature. But you know, I think as far as implementation goes, do you want to talk a bit about some of the corner cases that we identified? Like, I'm thinking like returning collections, for example, that are mutable or not mutable, and like.
Yeah, there's a lot of different ones there. One of the main ones that I worked with earlier was. Whether or not you want to return a mutable collection or an immutable collection. So whenever you index on a key, you'll get an iCollection of T value, of whatever that T value of the multi-dictionary is. So one of the early things that I decided was to return something mutable. So that basically you get another view of the multi-dictionary.
Okay.
So if you index on, say, Hayes, you'll get a list back with Ian, Anna, Robert, whatever. And then with that list, you can then add and remove from it. There's a lot of different problems with this, just in general, especially if you want to give an actual reference to the list being used in the multi-dictionary. Because in the multi-dictionary, it doesn't really know what's going on internally. So the current implementation has it so that you get a list back that's really just a wrapper around the multi-dictionary. It basically stores the key, and then every time you want to access that iCollection, it'll then go back to the multi-dictionary and make a reference there. So if you get a list back, or an iCollection back, and you say, add Angela, then it'll go and call multidictionary.add Hayes, Angela. And it'll do the same thing with remove and the enumerators so that the iCollection is always up to date with the multidictionary and all the other iCollection methods.
Okay.
So that was one of the big ones. Another one is whether or not it should implement iDictionary. So that's one that's...
Why wouldn't it?
So... That's one of the big points of contention with the multi-dictionary is
okay.
whether it really should implement it. it depends on how you want to view it. Because there's two main ways you can view the multi-dictionary. You can view it as a dictionary of T key, comma T value that allows multiple T keys to be added. Or you can view it as a dictionary of T key, comma I collection of T value with just a little bit of added help.
Mm.
So the original implementation views it as the latter way, or the former way. In which you just have multiple T keys. And there's implementations everywhere with either way. For example, Google's does the T key comma T value with multiple T keys added. or other implementations I've seen for C Sharp do it the way with the add collection.
Okay.
So the original implementation did go with the T key way, but it's sort of a big point.
Mm.
I haven't gotten a lot of feedback through MSDN one way or the other.
Mm.
People seem to like it the way it is, but there's a lot of feedback from other places that say different things.
Sure. Interesting. Well, you're always going to get that from a wide community of developers.
If you ask people, you get it.
Yeah, and they can also implement their own. Yeah,
that's right.
Roll your own if you have a problem.
Yep. So the way it works now is that it does the T keys with multiple T keys, but there is a function called toDictionary that will return a dictionary of T key, comma, I collection of T value. So it's kind of going for the best of the both worlds thing, but...
Yeah, that, I mean, in general, like, our team is very passionate about collections, right? I mean, part of it is because they're surprisingly simple at the surface, right? But once you actually go into them, they're the exact opposite. They're surprisingly complicated because, as it turns out, the implementation of the collections is certainly a well-understood and, I think, solved problem in academia, right? There's a bunch of data structures that are well-documented, well-defined, perf, profile, all of that. But the problem with collections is that they're so commonly used that it becomes really important that getting the 80% scenario to be super trivial, right? You basically want people not to have to worry about how I do my collections. And this also means less is actually more, because if you have, like, you know, we could have gone the Java or the C++ route where we have basically 100 different collection types for all purposes, and you can basically plug and play, you know, your own characteristic that you really want to get out of that. And yes, that means that for some scenarios you may get a better performance profile or whatever it is you actually want to get. But the problem is that if you think of a framework holistically and a bunch of libraries and an ecosystem out there, it's really important people agree on the types, right? I mean, a good example in C++ is you have a networking stack, you have a regex library. Well, I bet $100 that they don't agree on the string type that they're going to use on each side, because there's not like a well-approved like set of things. I mean, there's STL, but not everybody uses it. And so on our side, like, you know, we really want to get to the point where they can say, if you use it, you know, if you want to use a key value mapping, well, you use a dictionary. It's very well understood.
Mm-hmm.
If you just want to add a bunch of stuff, you probably use a list. And if you don't care, just want to have a stream of values, use an enumerable, right?
Mm-hmm.
But now when you add a new concept like multi-dictionary, the question is, what is it that you're going to add? Is it better performance? Is it more usable? And I think from our point of view, the big fee that we got was usability. It's really, oh, I wrote it a million times myself, but I have mine copy, you know, Matt has its copy, Ian has its copy, and if we all use it publicly, then we can actually exchange the types, right? And so getting the, what is it that most people want,
mm-hmm.
and then say, well, that still doesn't block you from doing it completely yourself.
Sure.
But like, we have this mantra of, like, you know, making everything possible, but keeping the simple things thinkable by not blocking the advanced scenarios. And like, that sweet spot is hard to actually nail. I mean, it's easier now, we can actually talk to more people.
Mm-hmm.
Like in the past, you just go dark, talk to a bunch of Microsoft people internally,
mm-hmm.
but then you have obviously this like relative distortion bias, right? And like, now, you know, Ian wrote a blog post and you have real customers talking directly to Ian. I mean, that's obviously a lot better than just trying to figure out what people may want, right?
Yeah, I mean, figuring out what people may want seems to be the old school way of doing
mm-hmm.
things.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make, you can't do that anymore. It doesn't make any sense. Now, with this openness that we have, I mean, pretty much your implementation is available for anyone to view, obviously, right? Your code?
Oh,
or not. You guys still aren't that open.
You mean the source?
Yeah.
No,
so let me ask you about that. So, and I bring this up only because, you know, at some point in time, I thought the BCL was going to become open domain.
Yeah.
But that never happened. I've been out of touch for a while.
Yeah, so that never happened. I mean, on our side, there's still all the people who push for that. Now, there's challenges around that because open source is not just source open, right? I mean, there's the license part to it, which is the easy part these days because
mm-hmm.
Microsoft has changed quite a bit how we do things. But, like, even if it would give you the reference source, for example, is out there. People can browse the source of the framework.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is that even if you would flip the license, it still doesn't allow you to rebuild parts of the stack yourself, which is a big part of open source, because you want to actually play with the bits, you want to mock with them,
mm.
you want to add your own favorite, you know, method to string and run with that implementation.
Mm.
But the problem is it's very hard because the whole stack isn't really designed to be basically pluggable from that point of view.
Sure.
And so ASP.NET, I mean, they're going the open source route now for most of their features,
mm-hmm.
but most of their features are on top. Or pretty much all the features are on top.
Mm.
Once you go the vertical and you do the whole framework, you run into a whole bunch of like technical challenges that we haven't solved yet. I mean, strong naming is one part of it, where, you know, math is another thing that we own that is open source, but you can't actually rebuild it and replace it in the context of an app because the identities are different. Mm-hmm. And so on our side, there's a whole lot of thought that goes into how we would open source the stack. I mean, it's obviously easy to just flip the switch and say, here's a new stack that's completely open source.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I don't know. It's a long road, but we still want to take it. But we want to do it one by one, and generate the value as we are doing.
Sure. I mean, the only reason I brought that up is when you think about it, C# is now open source technology,
yep.
right? And the thing about it is, you're going to have people forking C#. They're going to add
yes.
destructors, for example.
Yes.
Let's say someone wants to do that for fun.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? The people in C# world aren't going to accept that. For whatever reason, maybe they will. The point is, if enough people start using that forked version,
yep.
then you run into a world where you have this heterogeneous, where heterogeneity is actually a bad thing.
Yep.
So I understand the pros and cons of this stuff, but
yep.
It would be nice to see people forking more.
Oh yeah, of course.
Because then you're going to get really good ideas. So when somebody implements a new feature, and this is a relatively small feature, powerful and small,
mm-hmm.
if that went out open source on NuGet, people could just start seeing that implementation, and they could come
yep.
back and could start working together at little pieces of it,
yep.
as opposed to the whole giant BCL, which is kind of would be a nightmare to open source that, actually. So I just think that would be interesting, because then you have
yep.
The outside world helping the great work you've already started. But blah, 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 that's sort of independent of the
No, we are very passionate about open source. I mean, internally, we have switched to an open source model already in large chunks of the areas, and my team also owns a bunch of internal tools we are using, and
mm-hmm.
we already started to see pull requests for feature requests from partner teams, and it is obviously, from a developer point of view, it's a more social experience. Every developer likes talking to other developers, everybody likes to be passionate, be recognized for that, and
mm-hmm.
open source allows you to facilitate this in a much larger scale than just your immediate team, and I think there's no question that these things will happen. It's just a question of when, and can we actually, remove the technical hurdles that we have today in order
sure.
to actually get it done. But, yeah.
No, I understand. And again, just there's so many people that are using, if I'm a customer, I want to make sure that there isn't forked code in the BCL I'm
yep.
using, because then Microsoft will come and go, well, how can we support that? What is the type again that was added?
Yep.
Oh, okay. Let us do some research to try to help you.
Yep.
I can totally understand the complexity.
Yep.
So, how long did it take you to implement this feature? C# is a very productive language, and .NET's very productive.
Oh, yeah.
So, the thing that took the most time was by far the design. I spent most of the time on the design, and the implementation took me maybe a day or two, to be honest. So, it's just design and testing, really. And that was
cool.
Mostly the first part of my internship, so about 5 or 6 weeks, I'd say,
okay.
for all of it.
So in terms of testing, that's something we never, unfortunately, talk about. because that usually is the thing that happens after the design, which
yeah.
is really, actually, that's kind of a bad design. Because it should be part of your design. How am I going to ensure that what I'm designing is actually the right thing, right? So how did you test your design? How did you test that? How did you ensure that what you thought you were designing is actually what you designed?
Just a lot of functional tests, mostly.
Functional testing, okay.
Yeah, a lot of functional tests to start. I did performance testing afterwards to make sure it was sort of on par with what you'd expect from a dictionary tkey, comma, list of t-value collection, or something similar to that.
And that's important for a couple reasons. It's important just to understand where you are and to make sure that you've hit the complexity that you expect in your collections, and so... That was good to get done.
Yeah.
Cool.
So really just a lot of functional testing to see what you'd really expect from it. So I would do a dictionary of tkey, comma, I collection, t-value stuff, and then do the same thing with the multi-dictionary and kind of compare it and see that the functionality is the same of what you'd expect.
Mm-hmm.
And I just did that for all of the methods, all the properties.
Cool. And then you pass, you'd have your peers actually run through and code with it to make sure that the experience is what you were looking for. The productivity is kind of hard to measure with functional testing.
Yes.
So I'm sure you guys did sort of a, and of course you unleashed it on the public,
yeah.
which is a great way to do testing as well.
Yep. Yeah. Got a lot of feedback from the public as far as just small little things, all the way up to big things like design questions.
Cool. So what else have you been up to? I hear this isn't the only thing.
This is not the only thing, no. Since then, I've been working on another collection to add.
Okay.
And then I've been making small changes to the multi-dictionary based on feedback and inner feedback, things like that.
Okay. So just since we are in intern time now, it's nice and sunny in Seattle, our 1 month summer.
Yeah, it's all I know Seattle is.
Right, dude, it's incredible, isn't it?
We've been telling him it's like this all the time,
oh,
so
all
don't
the
burst
time.
The bubble. Yep.
No, it's great here, man. Well, look, one of the good things about the greenhouse effect is Santa Barbara's moving north. So let me ask you, the internship program, so for example, where do you go to college, and how did you find out about this internship, and why did you want to come do this?
So I go to college at the University of Texas at Austin.
Nice.
I sort of live outside of there, so kind of grew up wanting to go there. And then I learned about this through the recruiting program at a career fair.
Okay.
So I met with a recruiter there, gave my resume, went through 3 rounds of interviews, I guess.
Mm.
Came out here to do interviews and then accepted the job.
Cool. And so the interview process, I'd be curious to know what that is. I did the SDE interview way back when I started at Microsoft. What's it like these days?
It's a really good process, actually. I had a recruiter, I had a university recruiter, and then I had several different teams that I interviewed with.
Mm.
So I went through the first round, which was just a recruiter on campus, just came, asked me some technical questions, you know, whiteboarded them out.
Okay.
And then after that, I got another interview that was a similar thing like that. And then after that, they flew me out here to Seattle, and I went through 5 interviews on campus, on site,
wow,
with a bunch of different little teams, and then I got an offer that night and accepted it like sometime that week.
Cool. What was like the hardest question that you were asked? Remember
I'm
it?
Not supposed to tell you the question.
Oh, you're not?
Yes.
That would be cheating, wouldn't it?
Yes.
That would be cheating. Whatever.
Don't want to give out any hints.
We should open source the review process. Just kidding. Good. I'm glad that... So, it's nice to... You know, how many SDE interns usually come through your...
Oh, that's a great question. I think this summer is incredibly busy. We have like just in the CLR team, which is basically the people who own the JIT, the GC, the runtime pieces, and the core framework team. I think we have total like 8 or 9 interns this year.
Nice.
It's incredibly busy. I think on the average though, it's I think across all of DevDiv, it's probably a few hundreds each year.
Mm-hmm.
And so different teams get different cut each year, obviously. Also, the interest of the interns vary quite a bit. I mean, usually what happens is, and we have a bunch of interns, it's clear they get hired into Microsoft, and then
sure,
it's always this, all right, which teams do we have, and what are the interests of the interns, so that changes, obviously, from year to year. But
mm,
I think in total, like, we have, like, I don't know, 2,000 interns a year or something. I mean, it's quite a large program. Did you already have the massive intern party?
That is Wednesday. The big
nice
intern signature event.
Yes.
Good.
So when I was there, like there were like 1,500 interns, and like this was probably one of the biggest parties I went to.
It's true. Emo and I were interns at the same year as well.
Really?
Yes,
yes,
we were.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Mm-hmm. Were you an SDE intern as well?
I was an ESTED intern. I've been an ESTED actually till pretty recently, and I grew up in DevDiv, worked on the XAML technologies and .NET and CLR. So
cool, man.
Mm-hmm.
That's excellent. And then you made the leap from test to dev.
Yes.
Which now is the lines are very blurred.
Exactly. You know, as we were talking about earlier, Ian was responsible for a lot of his own testing and test design, when we went through the code reviews, we were code reviewing the code at the same time as the tests, and we were making sure that we were validating as we were committing the design into implementation. So
sure, I mean it is one of the things I know that there is somewhat of a struggle between having to implement, like back in the day when I was a full-time SDE, we had I actually started as a test as well.
Mm-hmm.
But when I moved into SDE, we of course had the program manager who is typically, you know, bothersome. Just kidding. Then we'd have the developer, and then we'd have the tester, or a couple, actually 2 or 3 of them. And then you'd crank code and implement a feature and then go test it. And then you'd wait, and then bugs would come and you'd say that's not a bug, it's that whole
sure
game.
Yeah.
And now, you know, the whole thing about unit testing and stuff like that. But the problem with unit testing is that it takes a lot of time. Right, that's the initial argument that you're going to get from a standard dev. It's like, wow, so I have to write twice as much code than just implementing this feature for you guys and having someone else ensure I don't rewrite a bunch of bugs.
The response to that would be that...
what is the response to
that? is that it saves you time, because when you're writing your tests, when you're executing your tests, you're debugging your code as you're writing it, and it's cheaper to find your problems, you know, when those problems occur, than to throw a bunch of code over the fence and come back to it in a week. So
Yeah, absolutely.
Totally, man.
I mean, it's generally the trend of the industry, right? I mean, like, there's a bunch of companies that don't have that split anymore between devs and testers.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them, especially for things that are very servicey, in general, they also have no longer IT guys, right? They basically move this whole thing together in one role.
And call it DevOps.
Either that or just engineer, whatever you title you come up with. But, mm-hmm. I mean, I think in general, like, when you want to minimize the feedback loops, I think, you know, eliminating artificial boundaries and process helps.
Mm-hmm.
But it's obviously also a question of, like, what team are you on, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
I guess, like, the thing that on our team is that we own some really high-level components, but we also really own very low-level components.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the stuff just doesn't quite work, right? I mean, for example, if you would think a JIT or a GC, it's a bit harder to, like, or just do tests first and run unit tests for that. It doesn't quite work that way. But the thing that we did totally see is that I think having, you know, the split between two people sometimes yields itself to this, like, organizational splits where you have these overheads where, like, a week delay happens quite naturally often because the way people are resourced. But you totally still need to have, like, different hats at least. And sometimes it's a different person. Sometimes it's just, all right, I put myself into the shoes of a tester, which is what Ian did.
Mm-hmm.
And you just try to be honest about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But the key thing with tests is also automation, right? If you don't automate, like, you have a huge test debt each time you add a new feature.
Yeah.
And then at some point it's just, oh, in order to chip this one thing, we have to run this, all these tests by hand.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, the biggest reason why devs are good at testing, because devs are inherently very lazy people. So if they see something that is manual, they start optimizing it and making it, you know, automated, right? And
sure.
We've been hearing a lot of discussion on this team about testing and the role of testing in the team. And one thing that people have mentioned is that having multiple eyes, where the person who's responsible for the quality of the code isn't the necessarily same person that's responsible for developing the code, is advantageous, because you don't have a tunnel vision mindset where you only see what you coded instead of what's actually there. And so one of the things that we've been working real hard on to keep that alive is strong code views with lots of tests in the code views. And that allows that separation where one person is acting in an adversarial role against the code, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not against the coder, but against the code that's been written and trying to break it and trying to find the problems in it. And so that's what we've been working on as a team, and that's what Ian was working on while he was here.
Absolutely. And of course, since you guys, you know, write a framework, you expect developers to use it. And so if I implemented this collection as you did, it'd be nice to have fellow developers vet your design.
Yep.
Right? That's the only, I mean, you can write all the functional tests you want. Sure, you give it a string, it doesn't break, give it an int, it gives you a warning, whatever. That's whatever. But I mean, that's an interesting test component that developers also have to be willing to just let it go and get the feedback from real experience. Otherwise, I mean, what are you doing? Right? You're not writing an operating system, you're writing a code for someone to use.
Yep.
Have you been through some adversarial design reviews and code reviews?
Oh, yeah.
How's that?
They're helpful.
Opinionated?
They can be a bit brutal, but they're definitely helpful.
Okay.
Like I said, you know, everyone has their own opinions on what it should be, so.
Totally, man.
But it's good. You want to hear that different opinions, because you can, like Matt said, you get kind of tunnel visioned on one thing. Like, this is what you want it to be.
Mm.
But you got to look at every point of view and see what exactly it should be and how you can help the most people with it.
Mm. And so performance is important for collections, right? I mean, that's kind of a no-brainer.
Yep.
So, you know, since this is alpha, I'm assuming you haven't spent a great deal of time optimizing it. You want to make sure your design works and people like it, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But like, what kind of approach are you going to take when you need to really optimize? So it's going to ship, let's say, time to optimize. What are you going to do? Have you thought through that process at all? I mean, like, just out of curiosity, like, what does that mean?
I don't know. I've really just been, so far for performance, just focusing on comparing it to the dictionary of Tiki, list one.
Okay.
And making sure that it is similar to that, or hopefully faster than that. It doesn't necessarily have to be, as long as it's just not inordinately slower than it. Because that's sort of the default that people look at when they think of, you know, what a multi-dictionary is.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it needs to just be on par with that.
Not only that, but the automated performance tests that you wrote are a great
baseline
to get us there, right? Because when you're working on performance, you need to know what your goal is, and you need to know where you are.
Yeah.
So having that baseline is going to
help us when we get to the point of having strong performance goals for the collection as it works towards release. Know where it was and know how to keep it where it was and get it better.
Yeah, exactly.
So have you done any, I know the BCL, there is use of, you know, the unsafe keyword, which is a very unfortunate name that the anti-native people came up with. So what I'll say is, are you playing around with that in your implementation?
No, I have not.
Okay.
The unsafe?
If you ever need to do, like, pointer arithmetic and all that kind of C, like, junk that no one really does that much anymore in the C-sharp world, but sometimes you need that level of control.
Yes.
Right? .NET Native doesn't give you that level of control. .NET gives you machine code from pressing F5.
Yep.
That's what it does. So is there any... What do you think about that?
So it's interesting because, I mean, you're absolutely right. Like, historically, .NET had basically not necessarily the best reputation when it comes to, you know, being raw to the metal and give you that level of control.
Totally understood.
And I think that has also changed quite a bit due to two reasons. One of them is... productivity is just one way that we want to have. We want to totally have like performance features too. And so recently we shipped SIMD, for example, which is a high-performance, low-level
cool.
library. But this library also has like a very strong tie into unsafe in the sense that once you're dealing with like large numbers of like, you know, I don't know, points or like, you know, vectors in general, there's a whole bunch of like interrupt going on between like native libraries and other libraries. And so this is a library where we totally have a lot of like pointer usage, and we actually recently did add some APIs to make it easier for you to construct vector threes, which is basically three floats from an unsafe pointer back and forth.
Okay.
And but I mean, for collections, like, I mean, the question is like whether unsafe would buy you a lot, because most of the problems that you have in collections is algorithmically, and then also how you lay out things in memory. Not so much whether you have pointers or not. Like, I mean, like, what's your organization? Like, do you have an array? Do you have a list? I mean, these are the things that even if you're in C++ and you walk a list each time,
mm-hmm.
you jump all over the place in memory, that's clearly not helping the prefetchers. You lose a lot of performance there. Once you have an array, well, chances are your stuff is laid out so densely that whether you use a managed array or a native array doesn't really change like the drastic picture
mm-hmm.
anymore. And I mean, we have a very large partner right now, which is Rustin, the managed compilers, and they use collections like all over the place. I mean, they basically just abstract the whole compiler into a bunch of collections, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like the whole all data structures, like the type, you know, the type system, all the rich information they collect, and they also had like very strong design goals when it comes to threat safety and immutable. Data structures, and then also the question like how do you update in a memory efficient way. And if you go in Rustin, there's not a lot of unsafe usage to begin with, and I'm not aware of any in the, you know, being in that level. Like almost all of them are at the lower level where they parse metadata from disk directly or they interoperate with VS. But when it comes to like, you know, collections, most of the stuff is really about like, you know, being smart about the algorithms, being smart about the data structures you're using. And you know, I recently saw the video. I think it was an interview between you and someone else. I'm not entirely sure, but basically, like, it was a talk, right? There was the lang.next where Bjarne Strustrup talked about
yes.
how awesome arrays are and how underrated they are. And
mm-hmm.
I mean, immutable array is a great example of a very simple data structure because it's just a struct wrapping an array. But similar to multi-dictionary, there's a whole bunch of like design thought that went into this thing, keeping it as low overhead as possible. And unsafe was not one of the things that helped us there. Right? It's really about how do things are laid out in memory,
mm-hmm.
what is what the CPU does, what is the system doing on top of that, like what kind of operations do you expect.
Mm.
And that is, in most of the cases for collections, probably the dominant case, not so much unsafe.
Sure. Makes sense. I mean, we'll see if you have the twiddle bits when you want to get that last...
Oh yeah, for sure.
You know, speed. Because it's important that things... happen fast. And .NET's very fast, man. At the end of the day, it's all machine code, right? The thing that slows .NET down is the garbage collector. And that's a whole other argument.
Yep.
And the type verifiability and whatnot. You know, the fact that you're running inside of a virtual machine. I don't think it's this or that. It's just interesting when we talk about performance, because that's sort of the big thing.
And .NET is moving native too, right? .NET native just was announced a few months ago, I'd say. So, yeah.
Which gives you the the unfortunate side effect of generating highly optimized machine code is the amount of time it can take to compile. Now, yep. they don't have the same problem that C++ has. That's a linker issue and whatever historical,
yep.
you know, the baggage of C that's never, ever going to go away.
Yep.
But .NET Native actually is pretty fast compiler experience, but it does have an overhead up front, which .NET people aren't used to.
Yep.
Right? Because you have a JIT that takes care of that at runtime. So right on, man. Anything else? So when did you get into .NET, and you know, how did you make the choice to be a .NET developer?
That's a funny question, actually. So I had not programmed with .NET before about 8 or 9 weeks ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I mostly did Java before that.
Okay.
Don't kill me.
No, Java's a wonderful language. So you were a managed developer anyway, right?
Yeah.
You had a really a language that was productive and, you know, vast libraries to use.
All curly braces.
Yeah.
Curly braces. We had a Java 8 talk. Unfortunately, we couldn't put it on Channel 9 due to whatever reasons. And that was lang.next.
Yep.
It was pretty interesting. They finally got lambdas. They're
yeah.
very excited
yeah,
about
that.
It's, you know, they're making some progress. It's interesting, in Java, it's like Scala is like even more popular than the Java language now in some circles, but the JVM is pretty interesting. Right? So you were a Java dev, got into .NET. How hard was it going from Java to C#?
It was a fairly smooth transition. There's a lot of things in C# that are, you know, sort of mirrored in Java. They're very similar languages in a lot of ways. I really like a lot of the different things C# has, though, versus Java, so I've kind of been swayed now to be a more of a C# developer, so it's kind of my go-to language now versus Java.
Well, it's always going to be, you know, the tool for the job, though, right?
Yeah.
But do you have specific examples of things that you enjoyed while you were picking up C#?
Just, like, aspects of the language in general?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I really like the lambdas, first of all, with delegate functions and things like that. Properties are really cool. Simple. But nice. Those are the main two that come to mind.
Mm-hmm.
There's just a lot of small things, I think.
Yeah.
Nice little sort of ease of life things versus Java.
I think the lambdas are things that you don't really realize how awesome they are until
yeah.
you have them, and then you have to not use them, then you miss them a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
Excellent, man.
What are you missing?
What am I missing?
Yeah.
I've not missed anything yet.
Yes.
I've yet to miss anything in specific from Java.
Okay. Well, does Java have, what is it, anonymous classes, like anonymous inner classes? No?
Doesn't have operator overloading either.
Okay. And it doesn't have the canonical thing everybody wants is non-nullable types.
Yes.
Right? Java doesn't have non-nullable types either. So two bad decisions.
Yep.
So we had to make sure ours was equally as bad. Just kidding. I love Anders, and I know exactly why he did that. But it would be nice.
Oh, yeah.
Because how many null reference exceptions have you run into over the last 8 weeks?
Not that many.
Nice.
A lot of testing for null reference exceptions.
Cool, man. So right on. It's wonderful
awesome.
To come and see young people. You know, pushing the boundaries and learning and helping us do the right thing. So look forward to see what happens with this multi-dictionary in practice.
Download it now on NuGet. It's the multi-dictionary on NuGet, published by, is it .NET? It's up there. Yeah, you'll be able to search for it, multi-dictionary.
Right
and
on.
It's right up there.
Play with it.
Mm-hmm.
Have fun. Give feedback. Nice to meet you. Good seeing you again, man.
Thanks.
Thank you.